Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network podcast, channel Environmental Studies. My name is Sean Munger. I'm a author, historian, teacher, and podcaster. And I have a background. Hello and welcome to the New Books Network podcast, channel Environmental Studies. My name is Sean Munger. I'm a author, historian, teacher, and podcaster. And I have a background in environmental history, and I'm going to be doing some environmental history interviews on this channel. In addition to this, I also have my own podcast, not associated with New Books Network. It's called Second Decade. It's about the 18 teens. That's available on iTunes and at the show's website, seconddecade.net. But here on this channel, I've got some really fascinating environmental history material coming up. And my first guest, I've just done an interview with Ryan Fisher of University of Wisconsin, and about his book, Cattle Colonialism, an Environmental History of the Conquest of California and Hawaii. This is a wonderful book. It just came out in paperback, and I have had a delightful time talking to Dr. Fisher about his book and about how particularly cows changed the world, at least the world of California and Hawaii, in the early part of the 19th century. So I think you'll enjoy it. It's a fantastic book. It's out from University of North Carolina Press. And I think anyone with an interest in environmental history is really going to get a lot out of this book. So let's get started with the interview with Ryan Fisher. It's a lot of fun. Thanks. Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network, channel Environmental Studies. I'm Sean Munger. I'm new to this channel. I'm an author, historian, teacher, and podcaster. I have a podcast in addition to this one. It's called a historical podcast. It's called Second Decade, about the 18 teens. That's completely separate than this. But this is my first interview for the New Books Network, and I would like on this channel to get into some environmental history. I have a degree in environmental history and find it very fascinating. And my first guest for this show is Ryan Fisher, and he is assistant professor of history at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. And he's written this really interesting book that we're going to talk about today, and it's called Cattle Colonialism, an Environmental History of the Conquest of California and Hawaii. I found this a really, really fascinating book. I'm very interested in the history of Hawaii, which is just really not a lot of people know about it, and it's amazing. So we're going to talk about Hawaiian cowboys, of all things. But it's a really great book, and I really highly recommend it. So here is Ryan. Hello, how are you?
Hello, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. Sure, thanks very much for joining us. So I wonder if you can just kind of talk a little bit about yourself, you know, where you went to school, that kind of thing, and how you became interested in environmental history in general and California and Hawaii in particular.
Yeah, well, I've always been interested in history, even when I was a little kid. So I always kind of knew I wanted to go down the grad school path. As an undergrad at Washington University in St. Louis, I had an environmental history seminar with a great environmental historian named Canaveri Valencius, who is in Boston now. It was an amazing seminar. And, you know, I think the second week of that seminar, I said, this is what I want to do. This is my history. I think it was Changes in the Land, the Cronin book.
Ah.
That kind of opened my eyes to that. So I became really interested in ecological change as a part of history and the way that people adapt to that change and the culture they create around that change. And especially sort of cases where you have different groups of people colliding with different environmental agendas and ideas about the environment. That was something that especially interested me. So then I went to the University of California, Davis, and worked with Louis Warren, who's a great environmental historian there, and a little bit with Alan Taylor as well. I also got at Davis a fellowship from the National Science Foundation dealing with biological invasions, which was a great graduate training program they offered that I was kind of put into the ecology department, basically the population biology department there, to take seminars and to work on projects. And so it fit really well with my interest about these, you know, moving organisms and changing ecologies and how people adapt to all that. And then I had to come up with a project, which is something that I didn't really have till the end of my first year. I knew I was interested in California, that's where my interest really lied, in those big changes that were happening.
Great. Yeah, you mentioned Canaveri Valencius. She's wonderful. I reviewed her book about the New Madrid earthquakes a couple of years ago. And I also kind of got bitten by the bug with her book on health of the country, because I've studied the early 19th century, and she's just wonderful. Yeah. Really, really wonderful.
Yeah, she was working on that book when she was teaching our seminar. Just great research. And also, you know, she kind of let us in a little bit on her editing process. And that was also really cool. So it was a great experience as an undergrad.
Yeah, that's really terrific. It's funny. I haven't actually met her in person, but I was doing research at Huntington Library, which I believe you also did, were there for a while. And I found a note from her in a source that I was looking at, a folder or whatever, that, you know, just talking about, oh, this page is missing or something like that. And it had a date on it. And her signature, and I'm like, oh, I know exactly what book she was working on when she wrote this note. So it's kind of funny. Okay, so well, why don't you tell us about colonialism and why you wrote the book, and just what you want us to know about it?
So as I was saying, I kind of had to search for a project that first couple of years of grad school, really the first year of grad school. I knew that California was really interesting. And it started out as a California project, and probably something involving ranching in California, because I knew that cattle had transformed California so dramatically. And I was looking for, I guess, a new hook on that. I just read in passing something about cattle being taken from California and moved to Hawaii. And I didn't know anything really about Hawaiian ranching, which, you know, I kind of wish I wish I had known more about this before I started. It's unfortunate, I think, that more people don't know about this. And, you know, people can take trips to Hawaii and still have no encounters with this really big part of Hawaiian history. It's ranching history. So it really intrigued me that there was this component to Hawaii that I didn't know a lot about. I always like kind of discovering new things in history. I kind of took on this. It made it a little bit harder because I didn't have a lot of background in Hawaiian history, but I took that on because it was so exciting to get exposed to that new element. So it started out with this looking at how ranching developed in California and then how it moved to Hawaii. But as I did a little research, I began to see how connected these two regions were, and that it wasn't just those initial cattle going from California to Hawaii, but these two regions were really very closely tied together, and cows were the element that made that connection early on. So exploring that connection intrigued me. And then also the parallels, and I'll probably talk about some of those as we go, but the parallels that developed between the two regions also, I thought, were really revealing that there seemed to be a pattern to how cattle were brought into these areas, how they expanded in these areas, and then the legal and economic and cultural changes that came along with the expansion of cattle into these areas. So seeing all those parallels and all those connections really got me excited. And so that's when I knew I had a pretty decent project. And then it was researching and writing after that.
That's great. It seems like I hadn't heard of any other, work that really, you talked about the connection between California and Hawaii, which is what I found so fascinating about the book. What was the state of prior research on this before you got to this?
There were some popular histories. A real fascination in Hawaii, I think, among people who live in Hawaii, in the history of the ranching industry there. So there had been a few popular histories. There's a veterinarian who used to work on one of the big ranches, the Parker Ranch, who's written a series of histories about this. But none of them took a very, very strong academic research stance on it. There were a few books on ranching frontiers that would always cover Hawaii. So that was sort of the main academic background as far as research is concerned. These big histories like Richard Slotta's, these big histories of ranching frontiers that would include Hawaii. But I'm hoping I'm not missing something big in my memory here, but there hadn't really been any books that had focused on the connections between California and Hawaii as far as cattle ranching or ranching history in Hawaii from the academic standpoint.
So this was kind of untrammeled ground then.
Yeah. Occasionally I would find an old article in a Hawaiian history journal that covered some good information and had great research. There hadn't really been a lot of focused attention to it.
I love how I was struck at the very beginning by just the image of the Hawaiian cowboy, which is something that you don't expect. I mean, you start the book with I'm probably not going to pronounce his name right. Ikua Purdy, is that right?
Yeah, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah. So, And then quickly you draw parallels between the Hawaiian cowboys of the 19th century and then the vaqueros in California. Do you want to talk about that and just kind of maybe the, just the image of the cowboy as it works its way through, through this history? There's a lot of cowboys in here and it's really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Hawaiian cowboys are called Paniolo, which even their name connects to this California, to these California roots, because Paniolo is probably a Hawaiianization of Espanol, because it was the Spaniards who brought over these traditions. But the Paniolo, as I was saying, they are kind of a big deal in Hawaii. And if you, you know, if you've been to Hawaii as a tourist, I think you could easily wander around Waikiki and Maui and not have much contact with the ranching history of the islands, but people in Hawaii, I think it is a pretty clear image in their mind of their history, these cowboys. And once I got started, I would always run into to Paniolo and the children of Paniolo. It turned out that one of my mom's oldest friends was the daughter of a Paniolo. So they're definitely a real presence. I'd run into people in the archives and tell them my research, and they say, "Oh, my dad was a pioneer." So this figure of the Hawaiian cowboy, it is a part of Hawaiian history. It's a part of history that a lot of Hawaiians are really proud of, and it is also it is an image, an archetype that's has been very multiracial in Hawaiian history. So I, in my time period before the 1850s, I'm mostly talking about native Hawaiian Paniolo, but eventually there are Japanese Paniolo and Filipino Paniolo and so on and so forth. So it's something that a lot of people feel a connection to. So it was that image though that really got me excited initially, you know, when I started to think about Hawaiian ranching, and I saw this this idea of the Hawaiian cowboy, because it was, it didn't entirely fit the image of Hawaii. It also didn't fit the image of ecological change as we often talk about it. And the landmark work that was really sort of a springboard for me and a lot of my thinking was, well, really two books by Alfred Crosby, The Columbian Exchange and Ecological Imperialism. And both of these have this idea, which is fascinating and illuminates a lot, this idea that Europeans bring over old world organisms, animals, and plants, and diseases. And that completely transforms the areas that Europeans colonize. Often at the expense of indigenous people. And that's one of the things that I thought was fascinating about the Paniolo image, is that these are indigenous people who are using these cattle and participating in managing the cattle population. So it seemed like a real, something that Alfred Crosby hadn't really talked about or thought of, that indigenous people often are making good use of these animals. And there's a little bit of that in the historiography. There's a little bit about, well, there's a lot actually about Indians and horses, but there wasn't nearly as much about indigenous people and cattle. So yeah, that image really fascinated me. And you do have some really famous figures like Akua Perte, who wins a rodeo competition, a national rodeo competition in Wyoming in the early 1900s. And so that kind of image, it is a iconic figure with a sort of different twist to it. And I thought that was really interesting. And it's kind of unfortunate that we do have a few famous Paniolo, indigenous Paniolo, Native Hawaiians who participated in this that we can name and have a real iconic perception in Hawaii. You know, there's a statue to Akua Purdy on the Big Island that I have a picture of in my book. It's unfortunate that we don't really have the same with the California Indian vaqueros. And then that, you know, began to fascinate me. Who are these people? Why do they not get as much attention? So exploring that part as well was something I wanted to do. Who were the Indian vaqueros in California? There was, again, this parallel idea happening in California of indigenous people managing, using cattle, learning this pretty skilled labor set to do this work. And so all of that really intrigued me.
The book really, I mean, it's two faceted in that it's really about kind of the trajectory of cattle in these societies and then the changes that those brought. But you do really keep the focus on people too. And that's very interesting. For the people who have not read the book, it seems a pretty key place to start is how did cows get to these places in the first place? How and why, both California and Hawaii?
The Europeans introduced cattle to both regions, and they did so very purposefully. And going back to that Alfred Crosby argument that a lot of European colonialism was backed up by these different organisms they brought with them, I think that you can show that very clearly in California and Hawaii. So in 1769, the Spanish colonized what we call California, what they call Alta California. This is, if you're from California, certainly this is kind of a famous story. You have the Franciscan missionaries coming in to start missions among the Indians, led by Felipe Becerra. But they bring cattle with them. And it is absolutely crucial that they have these cattle. That's going to be a major food source for them, that they don't have to spend a lot of intensive labor on. They can let the cattle loose on the grasses of California, and those cattle can turn that grass into food for the colonizers. So right from the beginning, they're driving herds of cattle to California. It would almost make more sense for them to colonize by the sea, by ships, because they have a much stronger sort of maritime connection from the west coast of Mexico to California. But they do this overland drive because they really need those cattle. So it's essential to the colonizing effort in California. And then in Hawaii, you have Europeans encountering Hawaiians with Captain Cook. Again, fairly famous story in the 1770s. Captain Cook finds Hawaii, discovers Hawaii, at least as far as Europeans are concerned, and ends up dying in Hawaii. But one of the men on Cook's mission is Captain Vancouver. And Vancouver returns to Hawaii in 1793 and really feels that it's essential to bring cattle with him. And so it's actually Vancouver who goes to California to pick up cattle, negotiates with the Franciscan missionaries there to obtain some of these cattle, and then ships them off to Hawaii at, you know, some expense, because the resources on a ship, an ocean-going ship, are limited, but he's willing to have the water and the hay that those cattle need, because, again, he feels like this is something that's going to be crucial to the future of British contact with Hawaii. Having a population of cattle in Hawaii will turn this into a provisioning station, which will help the British Navy, help other British merchants utilize Hawaii to their advantage. Although he does also establish it with some thought towards how the indigenous people can benefit from that as well. So he really does sort of sell it to Kamehameha, who is the king of Hawaii when Vancouver arrives, actually working to unify the islands under his control. Vancouver works hard to convince Kamehameha that these animals are going to be useful to the Hawaiians, that this is going to be a commodity that the Hawaiians can trade with the Europeans. So it's not entirely imposed upon Hawaiians. It is a deal that Vancouver makes to introduce these animals to Hawaii. But again, I think there's some of the same basic beliefs that this animal will undergird European colonialism.
I found myself kind of wondering about the motives of them. I mean, clearly the Europeans, when they came, had some sense of cultural superiority. And I was interested in the idea of them using cattle to whether consciously or unconsciously, to kind of reinforce that superiority.
Yeah. And that is something I talk about a little bit in the book, that, and this comes from some of the work of Harriet Ritvo, that Europeans during this age do have a real sense that their domestic animals are superior to the rest of the world, and having domestic animals makes them more civilized. And so there is a real link between these animals and civilization. And so going back to the Franciscan missions in California, getting the Indians to manage the cattle in the missions, it's not just something that's going to benefit the Spanish colonizers, who are putting some of the work, some of the labor onto the indigenous population of their own food production. But there's also this belief that it will transform the Indians and make them more civilized, actually learn this type of labor. And so I do think there's definitely that civilizing ideology that comes with the animal.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I think it is an interesting riff. I've read the Crosby, or at least one of the Crosby books that you talked about, Ecological Imperialism, which I've used in classes I've taught. One of the most interesting things I think about that book is the inadvertent colonization. Like his whole chapter on weeds, for example, was so fascinating. What you're describing really is much more of a conscious process and a designed process. And I think a lot of people haven't really thought about that. So I think that's a really interesting.
Yeah. I think the livestock especially, there's a more conscious idea about they're not thinking about the weeds as much, or they're certainly not thinking about the diseases because they don't understand germs. But the livestock, I think, are much more intentional and have, I think, a special place in European colonialism. At the same time, I do think there are unintended consequences with livestock as well, that the Europeans often will sort of unleash these animals on the local environment. They often don't have the labor force necessary. They don't want to build fences. So they're not working too hard to control the animals. They let them run wild. And that often causes destruction, which weakens the indigenous people, which also aids European colonization efforts. So there's some evidence of cattle causing destruction to indigenous subsistence in California. There are Indians who complain that they can't gather the same seeds and nuts because the cattle are eating them all. And then there's an even clearer case in Hawaii where there is indigenous agriculture, especially growing taro as the sort of staple crop. And there's a lot of evidence of cattle running into Hawaiian fields and just destroying all the crops, which in a way, in the long run, ends up helping the colonization efforts. because it weakens some of that indigenous sovereignty.
Hmm. Yeah, my next question was going to be how the cows changed both of these landscapes. I think we're started on that, but I was interested that it seems like they almost went feral in Hawaii, both naturally, and then there was a law against killing them, wasn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so part of Vancouver's negotiations with Kamehameha is he demands a kapu or a taboo on killing the cattle. And Vancouver's idea is that this will help the animals get established in Hawaii. So the sources differ a little bit, whether it's 10 or 20 years. I think it's 10. But for a long period there, the cattle are allowed to breed. And they're, no one's supposed to touch them. They become kind of sacred animals. Although it's very much by the fiat of law, because the king imposes this. There doesn't seem to be a sense that they're sacred, but they are untouchable.
It's not like India, where it's a cultural. It's a, right, it's a exactly. Cultural reverence. Yeah,
exactly. There's no sense of them as, or at least there doesn't seem to be any sense of them as sacred. There is a sense that this is a command from the king. But once they have that legal prohibition, the population expands very quickly. And we have evidence that there are no predators in Hawaii. So we have evidence that they are just growing at a tremendous rate. And so there are thousands of them by the early 1800s, a couple of decades. And so they are running wild, sometimes running through people's crops, like I said, and they do go feral. And it's worth mentioning, we're talking about longhorn cattle here. So these are cattle that, to start with, are not your docile modern breeds. They're already kind of a tougher, more independent breed. The types of animals that you really don't want to have them angry at you. And so there are stories of Hawaiians trying to capture the animals to sell them to ships, and Hawaiians getting killed in that process. So they really are feral. They really are wild and dangerous animals in Hawaii. And so they're a possible resource to use in Hawaii, but they're also a threat to the native Hawaiians.
So maybe you can talk a bit more about the connections between California and Hawaii. That was, I was so fascinated by the story in each place, but I was even more interested in the connections between them, and it seems like you highlighted that really well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the hide and tallow trade becomes the focus of these connections, and this is a fairly big business in the region in the 1820s and 30s, and really through the 1840s. It's the primary business of California, and I would also say it's the primary business in Hawaii in the 30s and 40s. And this is the trade of hides, which are used to make leather goods, and then tallow, which is mostly used to make candles. And it's not just California and Hawaii that are connected, but it really creates this very broad set of connections across the Pacific world. So, for instance, a lot of the tallow from California and Hawaii is going to make candles that are going to be used to in the silver mines of Potosi in Peru. So, and then a lot of the leather is going to New England or England, where there's a lot of manufacturing of leather goods. So there are these really broad connections throughout the Pacific and beyond the Pacific that are based on people harvesting the resources of these growing herds of feral animals in California, Hawaii. And this is a set of businesses are set up to really exploit these animals on the international markets in right after the Napoleonic Wars end. So in that sort of post-Napoleonic Wars, post-war of 1812 calm, a bunch of businesses go in, especially to the newly independent Latin American nations, which are all gaining their independence by 1820, 1821. So businesses go in from New England and England, and they go in to begin to buy these animals from Spanish missionaries in California who are using Indian labor in the missions, and then from the chiefs in Hawaii. The Ali'i, which is the chiefly class in Hawaii, are selling a lot of the Hawaiian cows for in this big growing international market. And so it is it's this international connection, but a lot of the businesses that are working to harvest the animals in California and Hawaii end up developing very close ties to each other. So you have this constant flow back and forth. California, in really until the gold rush, and even during a lot of the gold rush, is really a maritime province. It doesn't have a lot of land connections. It doesn't have land connections to Mexico, really. It doesn't have land connections to the eastern United States. So a lot of the business coming out of California is conducted along the coast and conducted by sea, and it becomes kind of a circuit for people to go to San Francisco, San Diego, Monterey in California, and then stop in Honolulu. And so that helps to forge a lot of these business ties in the hide and tallow industry. And again, that's all underwritten by this indigenous labor.
That's really interesting. On my other podcast, which is about the 18 teens, I did an episode on Hawaii. And one of the things that I emphasized was that it really was kind of a especially in that decade, becoming kind of a waypoint between, trans-Pacific trade, really, from China to, I was focusing mostly on connections to eastern United States, but that's so interesting that California was wired into that network as well. And that's something that you don't really think about a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I make a bit of a reference to California being almost like an island during this time period. And it does have some of those properties. And it is, I think, very much a network that links those two. Hawaii, there's a great historian of the Pacific named David Egler. And he talks about the different trade routes to the Pacific, including the China trade. And Hawaii is a way station on all of them. And, you know, if you look at a map of the Pacific, you can see why, because Hawaii is right there in the middle. But one of the problems that Hawaii has is everyone's stopping by, but Hawaii needs something that they can sell on this market that they're a part of. And initially they sell sandalwood, which is valuable in China, but they very quickly deforest their sandalwood resources. And so then beef and hides and tallow become really the resource they have to offer.
So how did cows change the people? We've talked a lot about the land and the economies, but how do they change the people in these places?
First of all, I think they change the labor of the people, especially as they become such valuable commodities. The indigenous people in both region increasingly find that their job is to take care of these animals. So you have a move away from a lot of traditional economies to this new ranching labor system. And so that's a big change. In Hawaii, I think there's a really clear shift, not among all the native Hawaiians, but many of them are forced to abandon agriculture because of the problems that cattle are causing. And so eventually becoming Paniolo is going to be their best choice. And so a lot of them are become these ranching laborers. I think there's a change in labor. I also think there are cultural changes that are harder to track. You definitely see cattle gaining more value as the indigenous people work with them more. And even though this is, in some ways, it's a survival decision to begin to work more with cattle, I also think that there are some pretty clear signs that indigenous people see the value in these animals, see that it can be very helpful. It can be an extremely useful resource to have this animal that can convert grass to food and provide these commodities that are valuable on the international market. They don't require a lot of labor, although you know, certainly they do require some. So across the sort of average Native Hawaiian or California Indian, you have that change in labor. And then you also have changes among the elites in Hawaii, who are the ones who are benefiting the most from this trade, who are using the cattle to expand their own resources and buy all these valuable European goods. But they also, I think, are changed by this process. They become more dependent on international markets. They, as they get involved in this trading, they sometimes find themselves spread thin and deep in debt. So there are some negative changes there. But I do think that there, in both regions, you can see the indigenous people seeing value in the animals, which is something that Crosby doesn't really talk about very much, Alfred Crosby. One other way you can see that, I think, is that in both regions, you have indigenous people participating in cattle rustling. This is especially true in California, where at one point in the 1830s, it really becomes a crisis that there's so much raiding going on of the interior Indians are raiding the coastal ranches and taking a lot of horses, but also taking a lot of cattle and then taking them inland. And it's a major problem for the coastal elites, the colonizers, the Spanish who are running the coast. So I think that's a case where you can see the California Indians seeing the value in these animals and doing what it takes to obtain them.
One thing that strikes me about this story that I found actually kind of refreshing is that this history, it's not really focused on coming. I mean, so many of the histories of both Hawaii and California really start with the United States presence there, American presence there. And almost all of this story is over by the time Americans actually get a strong foothold in both places. I find that very, very interesting that almost like kind of the cattle sort of prepared the way for ultimately American assimilation of both of these areas. I don't know if you had that sense as well.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I really chose to end the book with the ascendancy of the United States in both regions, because I feel like the cattle story becomes less important after that. In both regions, you know, California, you have the gold rush when the United States comes in almost at exactly the same moment. And in Hawaii, you have a transition to sugar plantations, which strengthens the presence of the United States. So I do think cattle kind of begin to lose their importance in the latter half of the 1800s. They're both a big factor. They're still a big factor in both regions, but they lose their importance But I think that's exactly right, that they have prepared the way. They have changed the institutions in these places. They have, in some ways, weakened the indigenous cultures. But in other ways, they have changed the indigenous people into the types of wage workers that the United States can use in its own colonial efforts in both regions. So I think that's exactly right, that cattle prepare the way, and then the United States kind of gets to benefit from everything that has changed on in both regions once they come in and really take over. Although you do, I guess, I would also mention that there are a lot of American ranchers in Hawaii who the Americans sort of take over that industry in the 1840s, 1850s. And you have Akua Purdy is actually the son, the half Hawaiian son of it's actually, I believe, an Irish immigrant, but he works for John Palmer Parker on the Parker Ranch, and Parker is from New England. So Americans also play a role in the development of the ranching industry, but the United States government, when it gains sovereignty, it's already sort of, the cattle industry has already sort of done its transformations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what, I don't know if that surprised you about this subject or your research, is there anything that in this story that like just really kind of upended your previous thinking or surprised you in some way?
The whole story in a way kind of surprised me. It was as I kind of felt out the boundaries of the story, I was again constantly surprised at how central cattle were to this whole region. The fact that the hide and tallow industry was dominant, was really the biggest export in Hawaii at one point. That surprised me. One sort of little story that really intrigued me, that maybe I can give you a more specific example of something that surprised me. There was this, there's a pirate who attacks California in the 1810s named Ippolito Bouchard. He's from Argentina, or he's working out of Argentina. And it's sort of a lot of California local historians will sort of talk about this incident. There's this pirate attack in the middle of the Latin American Wars of Independence. You don't really think about pirate attacks in California very much. But I started to look at this incident a little bit, and again, it was amazing how much it fit into the story I was telling. Bouchard, he outfits his operation in Hawaii, and he actually uses a partially Hawaiian crew. And then he attacks California, because in Hawaii, he hears about all of the hide and tallow resources that the ranchers along the coast are hoarding. So it's interesting that these connections between Hawaii and California, they enable the attack. And then the attack itself is Bouchard sending his men, including some of these Hawaiians that he's hired, to attack. And then the Spanish call on the Indian vaqueros to repulse the attack. They don't have enough guns, so they're using lassos that they would normally be using to manage the cattle to lasso some of these pirates. And it's this kind of crazy story. It's an entertaining story. Not too many people get hurt even for a pirate attack, so you can have fun with it. But it has this, it's all undergirded by the hide and tallow industry. And so, it was just surprising that everywhere I looked, if you're looking at California and Hawaii in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, it's, cattle are going to be part of the story.
Hawaiian cowboys to Argentinian pirates, that's such an interesting progression, and they're all connected. So fascinating. Every book has a story about how it was created. I don't know if you have anything about stories just from your research, or from, you probably took some interesting trips to research this book.
I had to research in Hawaii a fair amount. People would always make fun of me for my research trips to Hawaii. they all imagine I was sitting on the beach, which I did a little bit on the weekends. But I was mostly in the libraries. I went to a couple of different islands. There was ranching on every island, or at least I should say all eight of the main Hawaiian islands. So it really did spread throughout the whole archipelago, which was a good excuse to visit different islands. So I think, you know, one of the really interesting things was just driving, for instance, into the interior of Maui. And it's usually in the interior that a lot of the ranches are still around today. So you drive into the uplands of Maui, and you can really see, you can still see all this ranching on this extremely touristy island. And I did the very touristy thing of driving up Mount Haleakala on Maui to see the sunrise. And then on the drive down, I had to pull over because there were a couple of longhorn cattle that were grazing in a field on the road down. Just seeing the ranching. If you go to the Big Island, which I think is my favorite island, if you go to the slopes of Mauna Kea, you will see lots of the ranching industry. You could imagine that you're in a sort of typical Western landscape almost in some of those areas. So I think, you know, that was the most fascinating thing. It was nice to go to the beach after a day in the library or on the weekend. But, you know, one of the most fascinating things for me was just driving around the island and seeing how extensive cattle ranching was on all of them.
Well, we're getting toward the end of our time here, but I'm curious, and I'm sure everyone's curious, what are you working on now? What's your next project?
I'm working on something pretty different, at least as far as the region. I'm living in the Midwest now, and I'm doing a Midwestern project. So I'm looking at Meskwaki and Sauk Indians, or sometimes more commonly known as the Sac and Fox. Two groups that have a very interconnected history, but they had to move around a lot as they were impacted by European colonialism. The French fought a major war with the Meskwaki called the Fox Wars, a series of big battles, and that forced Meskwaki to move from Wisconsin to Illinois, and then you have, probably most famously for Americans, you have Black Hawk War, which forced the Sauk and Meskwaki to move to Iowa, and then they have to move to Kansas. But what I want to look at is, as they're going through all these migrations, these somewhat forced migrations, how do they adapt to the environmental changes that they have to go through? And how do they use their knowledge of the environment to shape their strategies as they're moving around? Because they're pushed out of areas, but they do get to choose where they move to, at least until the sort of very end of the story when the United States just ships them off to Kansas and then Oklahoma. But for a while there, over a couple of centuries, they get to choose where they're going. And I think it's really fascinating to see the environmental strategies that they use, and really the diversity of the resources that they draw upon in these places. So it's kind of continuing the story of adaptation, but it's in a completely different context, a completely different group, and a completely different region.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But yeah, there do seem to be some threads there that connect, you know, adaptation and kind of how people are changed, I think, by their environment and the stresses in the environment. That's so fascinating. Well, this has been great, Ryan. Thank you very much. Sounds like some interesting work for you coming up. And Cattle Colonialism is now in paperback. Is that right? Great. So it's a terrific book. It was a quick read for me. And I think that anyone with an interest in environmental history will find it very interesting. So thank you very much for being on the show today. Really enjoy talking to you. So hope we can connect again at some point.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
Sure, you're quite welcome. Okay, well, that's all for the moment. So thanks very much, and we'll talk to you later. Well, we've gone from Hawaiian cowboys to Argentinian pirates and California vaqueros and a lot in between. That was really wonderful. I want to thank Ryan Fisher for his fantastic interview, and thank University of North Carolina Press for providing me with this book, Cattle Colonialism, An Environmental History of the Conquest of California and Hawaii. Really, really interesting environmental history. I think all the fans of environmental history or history in general are really going to like this book. I couldn't put it down. I thought it was a story of a lot of importance and surprised me in a lot of ways. So thank Ryan Fisher. He was really great. And hope you check out the book. Again, my name is Sean Munger, and I have another podcast on iTunes called Second Decade, a history podcast. And you can also see it on that website, seconddecade.net. I'm going to be back on New Books Network Environmental Studies fairly shortly with another interview. I don't know. I've got a couple in the works, but more environmental history, some other interesting people researching some really, really interesting things. So I hope you join us, and we will see you next time. Thanks.